So I had you guys draw a picture describing one of your greatest accomplishments in life, because in my mind, if I was Elijah and I was to do that assignment, I would draw this picture on him being on top of the mountain and calling down fire from heaven and then executing those prophets of Baal. If I were to ask you, what does the Lord Jesus, Paul, Moses, and Elijah all have in common? What would be some of your answers? I'm looking for something in particular, but they do have multiple things that are in common.
You said Paul, Jesus, Elijah.
Paul, Jesus, Moses, and Elijah. Yeah, go ahead.
They were all human.
Yeah, good. That's a good answer.
They all wanted to fulfill God's will.
Good, yep. This is something that's like an event in their life. They had to all go through something.
Oh, they all went through trials?
Yeah, and one in particular is that they went through a time in their life where they were isolated. We know that Jesus spent 40 days fasting. We just read about how Elijah was by the brook Cherith, and he spent some time just by himself, relying on the ravens to feed him, which is interesting because all of them were seeking out the Lord's will, like you said. They were all zealous for the Lord, and they were all men of faith, and yet they all went through a difficult physical test or a trial to draw them even closer to the Lord. You know, sometimes when we get out in the woods or we come out here to this camp, and like, I'll be honest, like, there are times I'm like, man, I need to get on my phone and check some stuff. And I can't. Like, we don't have the ability to do that here. Like, we don't watch TV. And sometimes it's kind of nice because we're isolated. I know we're not alone out here, but it's different. Like, and for me, it's almost kind of refreshing because it kind of opens your eyes to how we can draw closer to the Lord when we pull ourselves away from distractions. The Lord went through great lengths to draw his people closer to him. And the question I kind of thought about at the end of yesterday is, are we willing to go through some hardships to correct our behavior? And what I mean by that is, if you knew you had a vice or something that you struggle with, and somebody came to you and said, hey, I know how to get over that struggle that you're having, but it's going to be really hard. Are we willing to do that? Because I want to say that some people aren't willing to do that, but these men of God were willing to go through difficult times to follow the Lord at the will, or the will of the Lord. Well, let's turn this morning to 1 Kings. First Kings chapter 18. I want to read those two verses that we've been reading before we get started again. This is James chapter 5, verses 17 and 18. It says, Elijah was a man with a nature like ours, and he prayed earnestly that it would not rain, and it did not rain on the land for 3 years and 6 months. And he prayed again, and the heaven gave rain, and the earth produced its fruit. We know that a prophet is somebody that the Lord uses in the Old Testament to correct or to teach the nations what the will of the Lord is, or basically to tell them, you need to change what you're doing. You need to get your act together. You know, sometimes as a kid, my father, I would do something, and my father would say, you need to get your act in order. But what I really needed to hear was, you need to get your act in order. Like, as much as I didn't like to hear my father say that, he was right. And here the nation of Israel is hearing the words of the prophet Elijah, and they don't like to hear it, and they think they can solve the problem themselves. But what they really need to hear is exactly what Elijah is saying. So we're going to start reading, and we're going to reread a portion that we read yesterday. We're going to start with verse 38 of chapter 18, and we'll read until 19, chapter 19, verse 8. So if somebody would read 38 through 46, and then somebody read 19, 1 through 8.
1838.
Yep.
Then the fire of the Lord fell and consumed the burnt sacrifice and the wood and the stones and the dust, and it licked up the water that was in the trench. Now when all the people saw it, they fell on their faces, and they said, "The Lord, He is God, the Lord, He is God." And Elijah said to them, "Seize the prophets of Baal, do not let one of them escape." So they seized them, and Elijah brought them down to the brook Kishon and executed them there. Then Elijah said to Ahab, "Go up, eat and drink, for there is the sound of abundance of rain." So Ahab went up to eat and drink, and Elijah went up to the top of Carmel, and then he bowed down on the ground and put his face between his knees and said to his servant, "Go up, now look toward the sea." So he went up and looked and said, "There is nothing." And seven times he said, "Go again." Then it came to pass the seventh time that he said, "There is a cloud as small as a man's hand rising out of the sea." So I said, "Go up, say to Ahab, prepare your chariot, go down before the rain stops you." Now it happened in the meantime that the sky became black with clouds and wind, and there was a heavy rain. So Ahab rode away and went to Jezreel. Then the hand of the Lord came upon Elijah, and he girded up his loins and ran ahead of Ahab to the entrance of Jezreel.
Anybody else want to read the next section?
What was it?
19:1-8.
Sure.
Thanks.
Ahab told Jezebel that all that Elijah had done and how he had killed all the prophets with the sword. Then Jezebel sent a messenger to Elijah saying, "So may the gods do to me and more also if I do not make your life as the life of one of them by this time tomorrow." Then he was afraid, and he rose and he ran for his life and came to Beersheba, which belongs to Judah, and left his servant there. But he himself went a day's journey into the wilderness and came and sat down under a broom tree, and he asked that he might die, saying, "Is it enough now, O Lord? Take away my life, for I am no better than my fathers." And he lay down and slept under a broom tree. And behold, an angel touched him and said to him, "Arise and eat." And he looked, and behold, there was at his head a cake baked on hot stones and a jar of water. And he ate and drank, and he lay down again. And the angel of the Lord came to him a second time and touched him and said, "Arise and eat, for the journey is too great for you." And he arose, ate and drank, and went in the strength of that food for 40 days and 40 nights to Horeb, the Mount of God.
Very good. Well, I had us reread the last portion there describing the events just after the altar was consumed by the fire from heaven, because there's a couple of things that occur. Like I said earlier, this is like a highlight of his life. And up until this point, it seems like Elijah is doing everything according to the will of the Lord. He's following the will of the Lord. He steps out in front of the king. He addresses the king and says, "You need to correct your behavior." And then we see Elijah following the will of the Lord and going out to Brook Cherith, which means to be set apart. We talked about, went through this boot camp like we discussed. And then from there he goes to Zarephath, or the melting point, or to smelt something, and he goes through these tests, and he's passing these tests with flying colors, right? He allows flour to feed them for a long time, and it's just a small little portion, and he ultimately brings the boy back to life after he has died. And that was the first time that's ever happened. It's not like Elijah could look back in the history of time and think, "Well, I heard about someone that brought somebody back from the dead previously, so maybe I could do it now." Like, this was unprecedented that anybody had ever done this before, and he was the first to do it, and yet there was no doubt in his mind that the Lord would provide in that situation. And then we see him here on the top of the Mount Carmel, and there was no doubt in his mind that this is the Lord's will, and it was, of course, you know, because the altar is consumed and the prophets are killed. Well, then it says here, in verse 40, it says, well, in verse 39, it says, "And now when all the people saw it, they fell on their faces, and they said, 'The Lord, He is God, the Lord, He is God.'" And then in verse 40, it says, "Elijah says to them, 'Seize the prophets of Baal, do not let one of them escape.' So they seized them, and Elijah brought them down to the brook Kishon and executed them there. there's two things. I passed out another worksheet for you guys to fill out today. I think it's only one page, so there's not too much. But there's two things that occur here in this verse 40 that I want you to take notice of. Because Elijah knows that a blessing is about to come to the nation now because they've been obedient. But in order for that blessing to come, the first thing the nation of Israel needed to do was to confess their sin. So here in verse 40 it says, "Seize the prophets of Baal and do not let them escape." So they seized them, and Elijah brought them down to the brook Kishon and executed them. So in order to receive a blessing, there must be a confession of sin, and there must be obedience. So here we see the nation recognizing that the Lord is God. They realize that their God was not the right God, but the Lord, He is God, just like Elijah's name means, "The Lord is my God," or "My God is Jehovah." And then after that, it's not just a confessing or a recognition of the Lord being God, but there is obedience that follows it, where they obey Elijah and ultimately they gather up those prophets for them to be executed. Now, at this point, if I'm Elijah, are you pretty excited? So for the answer, I put confession of sin and obedience. So at this point, if I'm Elijah, I'm pretty excited. Like, I would be at that moment that you guys described yesterday. One of you described a basketball game in which they won. I think that was you, wasn't it, Thomas? And you described a winning goal that you had made for a soccer tournament in the last minute. Like, that's an awesome point in your life. You're thinking, yes, this is it. Finally, it's all working out. Like, Elijah has been praying his whole life that the nation might turn back to him, and now they're saying, "The Lord is God. The Lord is God." They've obediently executed the prophets of Baal, and now you think this is it. Like, it's all finally working out. The blessing's going to come. Well, over the next few verses, there's a lot that goes on, and we're going to kind of go through this sequentially and see one by one the things that happen, because ultimately Elijah finds himself in a place that's not good. And once again, we began this study by reading a verse that described Elijah having a nature like ours, because I love the fact that the Old Testament and this passage gives us a little something about Elijah that's relatable to, because up until this point it's kind of hard to relate to him because of the events that he's done, but now all of a sudden Elijah starts making some decisions that aren't according to the Lord's will. And he becomes very human. He becomes very much a man with a nature like ours. So let's go through it sequentially. I'm just looking at my notes here. It says that Elijah... okay. In verse 41 it says, "Then Elijah says to Ahab, 'Go up, eat and drink, for there is the sound of the abundance of rain.'" So this is a bold statement. He's going and he's saying, "Send the message to the king because the rain is coming." Elijah knew that the events had occurred that needed to, and now the promise of rain would come. So it says, "Ahab went up to eat and drink, and Elijah went up to the top of Mount Carmel, and then he bowed down on the ground and put his face between his knees. And he said to his servant, 'Go up now, look towards the sea.' So he went up and looked, and he said, 'There is nothing.' And seven times he said, 'Go again.'" Now, I need somebody to volunteer to do something for me, because I'm going to read what this says, and I want them to describe or do what it's describing, okay? Who wants to do this? It's going to be embarrassing. Yeah, go ahead, Kai. You're the man. Okay, so step out of your chair here and show us what this looks like. "And he bowed down on the ground and put his face between his knees." Now, I've got a picture in my mind what that would look like.
Like this?
I don't know. You tell me.
No.
But then his face is in between.
He says he bowed down and he put his face between his knees.
It must
be flexible.
Yeah. Like, I picture something like that. And what's he doing when he's doing that? He's praying, right? Which, I don't know about you, but like, when I pray, I kind of just close my eyes and that's about it. Maybe I put my hands together. And we can. Like, I prayed when I'm driving down the road. I prayed in the middle of a soccer game or something like that. I don't know how appropriate that is, but the point is that we see Elijah posturing himself in a way that shows that he's very focused on the task at hand, isn't he? Like I picture, like you said, he's got his knees on the ground and he's got his face between his knees, almost like he's trying to just not be distracted by anything that's around him. All right, that's a good demo. That's all I needed. My point is that he is committed to the act of prayer, and he knows the results of his prayer. Like, he knows that the rain is coming. He is told, he has sent the message to the king that the rain is coming. But then what's it say? It says that he tells his servant 7 different times to go look towards the sea. And after the first time he sends him out there, the servant comes back, and what's he say? The rain's coming? No, he says there's nothing. There's nothing there. So he tells him to go again. 7 different times. Like, if it was me, part of me would think, well, man, maybe this isn't working. Maybe I should do something different. But he commits to it. He's focused on it. This is a great moment for Elijah, because once again we see him committed to the will of the Lord, and he knows the promises of the Lord. Well, on the 7th time, it says in verse 44, that the servant comes back and says, there is a cloud as small as a man's hand rising out of the sea. Now, that's a pretty hard little cloud to see from a distance. So I don't know whether maybe he looked up in the sky and, like, closed one eye and put his fist up like there and thought, well, the cloud's about the size of my fist. I'm not really sure, but the point is that... Yeah, he judged it somehow, and my thought is it's not a huge cloud, right? Like, he came back, maybe he said, well, there is a cloud, but it's the size of a man's fist. And even if he did do this and look in the distance, like, that's not a huge thundercloud coming, you know, like we have in the Midwest. But it didn't matter. That's all that Elijah needed, right? That's all that he needed was a sign from the Lord saying it's coming. So what's he do? He sends the message. And it says, he said, go up, say to Ahab, prepare your chariot, and go down before the rain stops you. That's all he needed was that little sign, and the race was on to get the message to the king, because the Lord was going to bless them, because the nation confessed their sin, they declared that the Lord was God, and they were obedient. So the promise would be fulfilled from the Lord. Now, it says, it happened in the meantime that the sky became black and the clouds and the wind, and there was heavy rain. So Ahab rode away and went to Jezreel. Now, my understanding is Jezreel was a place where the king at the time would go, kind of like a family vacation look place where they could go and kind of spend some time. It's not really that significant that Jezreel was down there, but it's a pretty good distance to get there. It's approximately about 22 miles or about 20 miles to get to Jezreel.
Hawaii for the Barack Obama.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was thinking. Just a place to go where you have to take a plane to get there or a boat. But then we have this really interesting scene where Elijah ends up outrunning the chariot to get there. So we're talking about a 22-mile journey, and Elijah supernaturally has the ability to outrun this chariot to get there. It's kind of a neat scene. Now, I've looked at commentators, and it's not real obvious why exactly he felt the need to beat him there. Except for one thing kind of stood out to me. Elijah knows who Ahab is married to, and that she is not a good person. So part of me thought that maybe Elijah got real excited and thought, I want to be there to see what happens when the king tells his wife about what's occurred. Like, it's so obvious that the Lord is God, and now everything's falling into place, and now I get to see the results of these efforts. Kind of almost like when Jonah, he expected Nineveh to be consumed, you know, like he'd given the message to the city of Nineveh. And he went up on the hill and he looked down on the city and he thought, this is it. This is when the fire and the brimstone is going to come down and the Lord's going to consume the city. Like, he had an expectation on what the events were going to happen based on how he thought the Lord would react. And maybe in the same way, we see Elijah running and he's so excited to see how the Lord's going to take care of this problem or how it's going to be so obvious that the Lord is God to the king and his wife, that he wanted to see the results of that. Well, unfortunately, it says in chapter 19 and verse 1, it says, "And Ahab told Jezebel all that Elijah had done, also how he had executed all the prophets with the sword." Now, the unfortunate thing about this verse is that it doesn't say, "And Ahab told Jezebel all that the Lord had done." What's it say instead?
All that Elijah had done.
All that Elijah had done. So right off the bat, we see Ahab putting the blame on a person and not on the Lord. It's almost as if, we know Jezebel was an awful person, but here her husband is not communicating perfectly exactly what happened. Instead, he's not saying, "Look what the Lord did and how he has proven himself." Instead, he's saying, "Look what this guy Elijah did. He's killed all the prophets." And her reaction is, "Well, I need to take care of the problem. So what's the problem?" Based on her husband's message, is it the Lord or is it Elijah? Elijah. Now, if they were smart enough, they would figure out that it was the Lord, and Elijah is just simply an instrument or a tool that the Lord is using. But either way, Jezebel says that she is going to take care of the instrument or the tool that the Lord is using, so maybe that will hinder the Lord from punishing them and the prophets of Baal. So here it says, part of me wonders what would have happened though if he would have told her all that the Lord had done. Like, would her reaction be any different? I'm not sure. Well, what's her reaction? She decides to attack the instrument of the Lord, or to attack Elijah. And she says, "So let the gods do to me, and more also, if I do not make your life as the life of one of them by tomorrow, about this time." So hack the clock, we say in the military. We say hack your clock, which means start the clock. Because Elijah's got about 24 hours before she's claiming that he's going to be dead, just like her, the prophets of Baal were executed. Now, at this point, Elijah has run to the city to see the events that would occur when the queen gets the message. And all of a sudden, she gets the message, and this is her reaction. Now, this is where Elijah becomes a man with a nature like ours, because what's he decide to do? He says, "Man, I'm getting out of here." I don't want to be too hard on him, because honestly, like, I could kind of understand that, right? Like, if somebody said, "I'm going to kill you in 24 hours," like, my first initial reaction is going to be to get away. You know, like, where can I hide, or where can I get away from here? And this is kind of what I like about the study on Elijah, is that he is someone that we can actually relate to. Because up until this point, it's hard to think about myself being like a guy that can call out fire from heaven. But I can picture myself as being a guy that would run away from a queen that was going to kill me within 24 hours. But unfortunately, in the next sequence of events that we're going to look at, we don't see Elijah pausing and praying to the Lord. We don't see him seeking out the Lord's will. And Elijah ends up getting himself farther and farther away from where the Lord would have him be. So it says that Elijah runs for his life, and he goes south to Beersheba, which belongs to Judah. Now, that distance is about 100 miles. Now, I don't know. I mean, we talked earlier about how Elijah would be kind of a mountain man from Horeb, a Tishbite from the land of Gilead. Maybe he'd be kind of a wiry guy, but this is probably supernatural that he'd be able to run 100 miles. But he is running because he is motivated to run. One time I was in a race. Now, I'm not a big time runner, but our school, when I was in the 7th grade or in junior high, we had a race every year that was about 3 miles. And I remember the first year I beat my friend, and he wasn't too happy about that. Well, in 8th grade year, he said he was going to beat me. And I was like, "Well, I'm going to try to run as fast as I can and not let him beat me." And I remember the whole race I was ahead of them. And then I started getting so tired. I was so tired. I'm like, all I got to do is stay ahead of them. Well, at the last turn, he passed me and he beat me at the very last second. And so he was telling all my friends that he beat me and everything and whatever. I mean, it did bother me. But I asked him later, I said, how'd you do it? Like, I didn't even hear you. He's like, well, I was breathing real hard, and I knew that you knew I was right behind you, so I just took a big breath, and I didn't breathe so I wouldn't make any noise. He said, I passed you because I tried to run as quietly as I could, so you had no idea that I was coming up behind you. And I was like, man, I can't believe you did that. And he said, the other thing I did was I pretended that a bear was chasing me. And I thought to myself, if a bear was chasing me, could I run any faster? And he said he could, so he did. You know, because you're never going to run faster than you will when a bear is chasing you. And my point is that here we see Elijah running 100 miles, and probably the thought was, is if I stop running, the queen and the king are going to get me and they're going to execute me. He was motivated when he was running this distance, wasn't he? Well, not only does he run 100 miles, he travels another day's journey after he drops off his servant. He's going out on his own. He's lone wolfing it, we call it. So at this point, he gets to the wilderness and he sits down underneath a broom tree. Does anybody know what a broom tree looks like?
Tree man under brooms?
Well, yeah. Something like that, I guess. It's actually not like a really tall tree. You could probably fit one inside this room. But it looks a little bit like a broom upside down, where it's like it spreads out real wide, and it's not real tall, but it's not real big, but it does provide some shade. It's kind of like there's a little area underneath it that you can lay down and rest. So he sees a broom tree there, and he lays down and decides to get some rest, because he's probably at this point physically exhausted. And at this point, he says a prayer that he might die. He says, it is enough. Now, Lord, take my life, for I am no better than my father's. Now, this is just a few verses after we see Elijah on the top of Mount Carmel. And people are calling out, saying, the Lord, he is God. The Lord, he is God. And yet here, just a few moments later, we see Elijah laying underneath a tree, calling out to the Lord, saying, take my life, for I am no better than my father's. Well, there's some lessons that we can learn from these events that we've gone through. And one is the fact that what is your reaction to God's action? And up until this chapter, or these verses that we read, Elijah's reaction is really good. His reaction to the Lord's will is perfect. But now we have a sequence of events that don't fall into place with what Elijah was expecting, and his reaction is not a good one, to the point where he has drawn himself away and he is now calling out for the Lord to take his life. You know, the interesting thing is that eventually Elijah would have his life taken by the Lord, not in a way that we are used to, but the Lord would literally take him off this earth. And so in a sense, the Lord would answer that prayer, but it wasn't until Elijah did the job that he would have him to do. I'll just mention here in verse 3, did somebody read something other than the King James Version?
I did. I read ESV.
Okay, read chapter 19, verse 3. What's it say?
Then he was afraid, and he arose and ran for his life, and came to Beersheba, which belongs to Judah, and left his servant there.
Okay, good. And so it says, his version says, and he was afraid. Now, I think that is the most accurate translation of what happened here. My version is a New King James. In verse 3 it says, and then he saw, basically saying that he saw the message from the queen saying that his life will be taken. And my understanding is that when the King James was translated, those translators didn't like the idea that Elijah was afraid, even though the root word was that he was afraid and he ran because of his fear. So if your version said Saul, that's fine, because we're going to see that with these problems that he is having, that even if he did just see it, his reaction to it isn't a good one. And I just thought I'd point that out to you, that I truly believe that he is running out of fear for his life. All right, well, in your workbook here, we have four things that are problems that Elijah has to deal with. The first is, and it's probably the biggest, we'll spend the majority of our time tomorrow talking about this, and that is the problem of our expectations. Elijah had an expectation of what was going to happen, and because those expectations weren't being met, he ends up taking matters into his own hands. He was expecting something different. He was expecting something more positive to occur, maybe for himself. And maybe in a sense he thought, I'm doing everything right. I'm following the will of the Lord. I'm getting the results that I wanted as far as the prophets of Baal have now been executed. And yet it says that all of a sudden his life is in danger. Now, if you are me, and it sounds like Elijah's kind of like me, I would think that the Lord would have maybe preserved him. If anything, the Lord would have blessed him for doing everything right, you know. But life is full of disappointments, and if we're not careful, these expectations that we may have, these expectations of a blessing when the Lord hasn't promised us anything, as far as material things in the world, we can disappoint ourselves. In 1 Corinthians chapter 13 and verse 7, maybe we'll just turn there real quick. First Corinthians 13 and verse 7, describing love, it says that love bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, and endures all things. So what are the four things that love does in this verse? Love bears, what else?
Believes, hopes, and endures.
Hopes and endures. Now, the thing that we love to think about is that the love believes all things and that love hopes all things. But those two things, believing and hope, are sandwiched in between what? What's the first one and the fourth one?
Love bears and
bears. Bears and endures. So the point is, we love to think about how love believes all things and love hopes all things, but that's sandwiched in between bearing and enduring. Sometimes we let our expectations get in the way of the fact that the Lord allows love to bear and endure the things that occur to us. Now, my grandma would never buy my sister and I Christmas presents for Christmas, which is fine, because what she would do is she'd send us a card in the mail, and what, guess what was inside the card?
Moolah.
Yeah, yeah. So I don't know about you guys, but it was always kind of like, you get, you know, it was Christmas morning, and Mom came in and said, here's your Christmas card from Grandma, and you open the envelope up, and you open the card up, and you always kind of like shake the card, you know, see if there's something in there, and there always was. It was a check for, I think it was like $25. And, so I open mine up and the check falls out and I read the letter and I'm like, oh yeah, $25 from Grandma, and I got real excited. Well, then my sister opened up hers and the check fell out and she goes, oh yeah, $50 from Grandma. And I said, what? I said, that's not fair. I said, that's not fair. Well, she was joking. It was like, it was kind of a joke she pulled on me, and I fell for it because I didn't like the idea that she would get twice as much money as me. Because my expectation was is that we would get the same amount from our grandma, of course, and we did. Well, the problem is that this is going to be a hard concept, and I want to treat you guys like you're mature believers, but there is no promise in this world from our Lord that life is going to be fair. There's no promise from God that says that life is going to be doled out equally, or the blessings are going to be doled out equally to all of the believers or all the Christians in the world. And that's something that's really hard for me to think about, because sometimes I'll look at another believer and I think, well, why is it that they always, everything seems to work out for them? And yet, for me, things just seem to be so much harder. And, like, that's a tough lesson in life, to think that sometimes life just isn't fair. Even as a Christian, even though I'm doing everything right and I'm following the checklist, and even when things work out, sometimes they just don't work out the best for me. And that's a really hard lesson to think about. I want to present this question to you, and I don't want it to freak you out, but how comfortable are you with the idea that you're placing your faith in a God that has the right and the power to allow life to not be fair? And this is a really difficult concept to think about, but the reality is that God is God, and He is the creator of the universe. There is nobody more powerful than God or Jehovah. And Jehovah has the right to allow some things to be really good for some people and some things to be really bad for other people. And like, as much as I want everything to be fair and equitable, sometimes life just doesn't work out that way. And the question is my faith going to be dependent upon me getting blessings or the Lord taking care of me compared to other people? And I would hope that it's not. Well, here Elijah is in a situation where he has done everything right. There is no one else in the kingdom of Israel, which is to the north, like we talked about. He is the guy that is doing everything right. He's the one taking that bold stand in front of the king and saying, if you don't change your ways, the Lord will punish you with a drought. And he does. So Elijah's the one guy doing everything right. So you would think that Elijah would receive a greater blessing than anybody else, right? And yet here we see Elijah's life being threatened to the point where they're saying, in 24 hours, you're going to be just like these other prophets that you've executed. And it seems as if things aren't working out. It's not fair. If anything, Elijah should be blessed, and now it seems like he's been cursed by the queen. His expectation caused him to take matters into his own hand. The other problem that we see is the problem of our focus. Now, have you guys ever watched a basketball game where somebody is shooting a free throw and they're in the other stadium? What happens? The other fans are trying to distract him, right? Now, like, at some point, it gets kind of humorous what these guys are doing, especially college games.
Like, see, they won't like to have a curtain.
Yeah. I mean, like, let's be honest, man. If I was shooting a free throw and that was going on, like, I kind of want to watch it, you know?
Laughing and stuff.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, funny. Some of the things these people do. Or, like, what's the loudest stadium in the NFL? You guys have any idea?
Arrowhead.
The Arrowhead Stadium, that's right. So anybody that comes into Arrowhead Stadium, man, it is just so loud. Like, I haven't been to a game since I was your age, but my understanding is it is just so loud. Like, the Seattle Seahawks, their stadium is really loud, too. They've actually engineered the stadium to reflect the sound down onto the field so that the other teams get distracted with the sound. So what do teams do when they prepare for that? They, you know, a football team will actually pipe in really loud music so that the players have to practice calling out the plays, and the quarterback has to practice calling out these plays with really loud music. So it's like they're trying to show them what it's going to be like to be distracted in these other stadiums, because the other fans are going to try to distract them from getting the job done that they need to. Now, what do you do to make sure that you can make a free throw? I've never had to shoot a free throw when so many people were trying to root against me from making it. I mean, I can go in my front yard and shoot free throws and think, well, I'm pretty good at shooting free throws, but I've never been in a situation like that. And I would like to think that I could just block it all out and I'd be able to focus on the job, but I don't know if I would. It just seems like there's so many distractions. There's a movie in which there's a pitcher, and it was just kind of a neat scene in the movie where the crowd is booing him, they're yelling at him, and it's so loud, and the pitcher says something to the effect, he says something like, clear the mechanism. And as soon as he says that, everything goes quiet, and the whole theater is quiet. It's just like, it goes from being so loud to like, nothing. And they're trying to show that this pitcher had the ability to just block it all out, and just completely focus on the job at hand. As Christians, we need to keep our eyes on the prize. And just like a person that has that ability to step on the basketball court and shoot a free throw no matter what, like some players, it's just like they have that ability. Like Michael Jordan, because he can make a free throw and make it look so easy, even though so many people were trying to distract him. You know, as Christians, we need to keep our eye on the prize. And here we see Elijah. He should have just kept his eyes on the Lord's will. He should have sought the Lord out first. But instead, we see him running and taking matters into his own hands. You know, even if the translation in chapter 19, verse 3, instead of, and he was afraid, instead of saying afraid, if it was true that he saw that, if he did see it, that means his eyes were taken off of the prize or the end goal that the Lord had. He saw something that affected him personally, and he ended up running, trying to take care of it himself. Well, you know, as Christians, I think it's okay to recognize the fact that you're about to, in our example, go into a basketball court and realize that that game is not going to be played with your fans. And my point is that, like, you know, as a Christian, some people would say, well, I'm just going to go live up in the woods and I'm not going to pay attention to any of that stuff so I can stay focused on the Lord. And I understand what they're saying, but, you know, as a Christian, we need to know what's going on around us. We need to have situational awareness to know that there are things that are occurring in the world, but we just don't want those things to distract us from what's happening. You guys ever heard that an ostrich sticks its head in the sand? Like, I don't know if that's true. I don't think it is. But it's this image where the ostrich gets scared, so he just sticks his head in the sand and just pretends that there's nothing else going on around him, right? Well, as a Christian, we're not supposed to do that. We're not supposed to just, like, keep our head down and just pretend that there's nothing going on around us. I think the Lord wants us to know that there's evil out there and there's bad things happening, but at the same time, He wants us to be aware of it, but not distracted by it.
Because it's in a peripheral vision.
Exactly. Let's take a look at Romans chapter 4. We're going to read Romans chapter 4, verses 17 to 22. And I'll go ahead and read it. It says, as it is written, I have made you a father of many nations. In the presence of Him who He believed, God, who gives life to the dead and who calls those things which do not exist as though they did, who, contrary to hope, in hope believed so that He became the Father of many nations according to what was spoken, so shall your descendants be. And not being weak in the faith, He did not consider His own body already dead since He was about 100 years old in the deadness of Sarah's womb. And He did not waver at the promise of God through unbelief, but was strengthened in faith, giving glory to God. And being fully convinced that he had promised, He was also able to perform, and therefore it is accounted to Him for righteousness. What is this describing?
Abraham.
He's about 100 years old, and the Lord has promised him that an entire nation will be his descendants. Now, up until this point, what's the problem?
Abraham,
he's too old, he doesn't have any kids, right? And like 100-year-old people don't typically have kids. So the Lord says, well, you're going to have a whole nation come out from your descendants. And Abraham is basically, you know, his wife laughs at the idea, right? Physically, like, this seems impossible. And my point in sharing this verse with you is that Abraham was aware of the physical limitations of having kids at that age. But that didn't stop him from being faithful to the Lord and not doubting the Lord's will in his life. And he is now being recorded here in the New Testament as being a man of faith, because despite the physical limitations that Abraham was well aware of, he still sought out the Lord's will and followed him. The third problem is the problem of our strategies. You know, Elijah probably had an idea of how things should have worked out, and he was doing everything right. Everything seems to be working out, and maybe his strategy was working, and it seemed like if he was playing a board game, his strategy on the board game was allowing him to win the game. But here all of a sudden his strategy doesn't seem to be working out according to his plans, and now he takes things into his own hands and he finds himself underneath this broom tree. And we just need to be careful, because we can come up with a strategy on how our life should go, and if it's not according to the Lord's will, and if we're not seeking out the Lord's will, then that can get us into some trouble. I had a friend of mine that he told me at one point he was going to marry this one girl, and he was sure of it. And that's okay to have a strategy of that, but the problem was he was dating another girl when he told me that. And I was like, well, if this is your strategy to marry this girl, what are you doing dating this other girl? You know, like, he was kind of all over the place. And I just remember kind of laughing at him. I'm like, well, if you're going to marry this other girl, then why are you dating this one? Like, his strategy on how he was going to accomplish his goal was not very good, you know. And I don't know if you guys are interested in girls, but like, at some point you might, and if you do, you probably don't want to date another girl if you want to date another one. That's not a very good strategy. You know, as Christians, we can come up with strategies on how we're going to accomplish something, or how we can we may even say, this is the strategy I'm going to have to follow the Lord's will. But if we're not actually seeking the Lord's will and creating this strategy, things probably aren't going to work out in our favor. We see Elijah here reacting to the situation as opposed to responding to the Lord's will. Like I mentioned earlier, at no point during these verses do we see Elijah stopping and putting his face between his knees and seeking out the Lord's will through prayer. Instead, he's taking things into his own hands. And literally running hundreds of miles to get away from the situation. If I were to ask you today what your expectations are for your life, you know, I would hope that you would seek out the Lord's will for you first and foremost. You know, my kids, they're so young, but they have expectations of certain things. And when they don't get those expectations, it becomes like they're demanding that it happen. Like, for example, let's say last night my youngest wanted to stay up and drink a pop. That was his expectation. Now, I don't typically let my kids drink caffeine. I don't let them drink a lot of caffeine at all, but like, if I do, I don't let them drink it really late at night, because I don't want them to stay up all night, right?
He's like, you're asleep.
Yeah, I don't want to deal with these kids all hyped up on caffeine and sugar. But, you know, my son wanted to drink a pop, and he had, for some reason, an expectation that that was okay. So when I told him, no, I'm not going to allow you to do that, he threw a fit, because his expectation became more of a demand. Now, if we go to the Lord and say, Lord, I'm expecting this to happen, and it doesn't happen, and then we demand that it happen from the Lord, that's not a good place to be in. Next thing you know, we'll be sitting underneath a broom tree calling out to the Lord saying, take my life, because things aren't working out to the way I thought that they should. The last problem that we'll look at is the problem of consequences. We're not going to spend much time on that today, because that's really what we're going to look at tomorrow. It's unfortunate, because we find Elijah discouraged, he's depressed, he's hiding, and he's failing to minister to his people. He's all alone. He's underneath the broom tree. And he now has to deal with this problem of the consequences of him taking things into his own hands. Maybe we'll just end with that. But let me ask you this. Have you guys ever experienced something that you felt like wasn't fair? what? You got something in mind?
Yeah, it was during a soccer game. I was smaller than this guy.
Yeah.
And like, we ran beside each other and he flopped. And like, the ref gave me like a red card for shoving him over.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So it was kind of unfair because I'm like much smaller.
Yeah, yeah, that's not fair. Anybody else?
Well, I thought it whenever I was little, but school. So I changed my mind there.
Yes. Like your brothers and sisters got treated differently or something?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, we can all think of examples where we thought things didn't work out to our advantage. What did you do to try to make it right?
Showed the rest of the footage.
Well, you couldn't.
At the end of the game, we did. And he's like, oh, well, I'm sorry. I was like, yeah, okay.
How'd you do that?
Because we had a Kelly camera on that day behind the goal.
Oh, okay.
So you just watched it after the game and just showed him.
Oh, that's I'm impressed he would even watch it. You know. That's good because, you know, you could have taken things into your own hands.
That really
stuck. Yeah, I know. You don't want to do that, you know. You know, when things work out and we feel like they're not fair, sometimes we're tempted to do that, to just, well, if this isn't going to work out the way it should, I want to make sure it works out the way it should. You know, if that guy's going to give me a red card, well, if I want to get a red card, it's going to be for...
It's going to be big.
Yeah, yeah, it's going to be for the right reason. And since I'm paying for the licks, I might as well get them in while I can, you know. You get kicked out for a red card?
Yeah, you can't win the rest of the game.
Yeah, man, so like you could have just been like... But you didn't, and that's my point, is that we may feel like we need to take things into our own hands to make things fair, but that's not really our place to do that. Well, let's just go ahead and close in prayer. Father, we do come before you, and we've got four good boys here, and we know, Lord, that they want to seek out the Lord's will in their life. And here we picture a man with a nature like ours, and he's done great things for you. He's a legend of the Old Testament. But we see today that he was a man who put his face between his knees and he prayed to you that your will would be done. We think, Lord, of how he came from a great moment in his life, and just a few days later he would be underneath a tree all alone, having taken things into his own hands, and he was calling out for his life. Lord, he was having a problem at that point of dealing with not being focused on you. He had a problem that he was now going to have to deal with the consequences of taking things into his own hands. So we do pray, Lord, a blessing on this study as we finish it up tomorrow. We pray these things in Christ's name. Amen.